Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken, it's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Final Say Radio Program with your hosts, John and Brett Rappaport. Brett Rappaport is out of the saddle today, and I don't blame him. It's a great day to play in the snow. I'm not accusing him of playing in the snow, mind you, but it would be a great day. We have an awesome show today. We have two guests lined up for you. First, both who are actually, they're not just guests, they're good friends, and arguably they're more than just good friends, they're also our co-hosts and dedicated loyalists. So joining us through the entirety of the show is Tiffany Gubé. And, of course, Tiffany Gubé is kind of like a sister to Brett and I, amazing person. And Tiffany is actually a partner in Quidlibet Research, but also a fellow at the London Center, which, of course, we had a guest from the London Center on yesterday, Tony Schaefer. So, Tiffany, happy Tuesday, and welcome to the show. How are you?
Happy Tuesday. I'm doing really well, thank you. I'm very happy to be joining you for the full duration of the show.
And do you have snow? I was so excited when I woke up to snow because I feel so gypped. I feel like I've been 10 feet below the real snow line, and we keep getting a dusting when everybody else is getting the good stuff. I know that must be, you know, different than most adults, but
yeah. Well, I'm actually in Chicago right now, and it's not too bad today, but it's been pretty brutal. And I've got a lot of friends in the Boston area who just can't come up for air, so it's been rough out there.
Yeah, my daughter's had an interesting initiation in Ithaca because it's been, you know, one of the coldest. Global warming stuff is a killer.
I was going to say, how about that global warming?
Well, it's not working so well for her toes, but, you know, we got her the right shoes, and, you know, as somebody who hated the cold weather, somehow she's actually found it to be, quite enjoyable. You know, walking through corridors of, probably shoulder-high snow walls on campus, probably is a bit of a thrill, you know, you don't get in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Very true.
So, Tiffany, there are so many subjects today. I mean, I don't know where we can even begin to cover them all. But one of the things that really struck me was there was a report that just came out that from the American Political Science Association. So, of course, these are your poli-sci guys who fancy themselves to be great historians and know all things about politics. You know, my feeling is from tip to tail, you know, bow to stern, anybody involved in the political spectrum, despite whatever they say, be it radio show hosts, policy experts like yourself, doesn't matter. We're all biased. Let's be honest. We're all biased. So with that in mind, though, it is worthy of note when you have people from academia who normally you would think would have that similar, thrill up and down their legs, a la Chris Matthews. And they're actually ranking Obama. They all seem to like him, but even though that they predominantly like him, they're basically rating him as a mediocre president. And I think that's very telling, very, very telling indeed. So I'm happy to see the shift, not because I welcome having a president who ranks so low in the seat, but given the damage that this president is doing, at some point, the mainstream media flying air cover for him has got to end, so this country has an opportunity to minimize the amount of damage he could do in the remaining almost 2 years. years and reduce the amount of healing that we're going to have to do. And I mean healing in every sense of the word. I mean, he's divided the country. He's redistributed our power around the world. He's redistributed our financial clout around the world. You know, he's basically nullified so many aspects of what the Founding Fathers built in the Constitution, and you can go on and on and on. But anyway, so that gives me a little bit of hope. Tiffany, how about yourself?
It does give me some hope. It would give me more hope if I felt that the same critics, even ones who fall on his side of the political aisle, wouldn't be voting for Hillary, because I know as much as they may finally be critical or opening their eyes with regards to Obama, that doesn't mean that they're going to end up making the right decisions in 2016 that are going to give our country a chance to heal. But yeah, I mean, there comes a point where even if you supported this president and you voted for him, at what point is it just, are you almost embarrassing yourself to keep providing this kind of cover for him? I mean, when you have Chris Matthews actually acknowledging on national television that he is humiliating this country and our standing in the world, I mean, that tells you everything. So I am very happy. Unfortunately, it's also a little bit too little too late. There is so much damage that has been done and will continue to be done until 2016 that is some of it irreparable, a lot of it going to take a very long, hard approach of trying to rectify. And while I am glad that his supporters are at least not so mentally ill that they can acknowledge some of the more egregious things that Obama's been guilty of, little too late, and they're still going to vote for Hillary in 2016. So it's small consolation for me.
It is. You know, there's two things that have been going on in the Twitter sphere that I've taken in a little bit because I think it's an interesting social science experiment and a little bit of fun. But one hashtag is I Love Obama. And I don't know if you haven't done that, you got to check out some of the I Love Obama hashtags. I've probably thrown 20 out myself, and almost all of them are actually anti-Obama, but filled with creative, simple sarcasm and a brilliant analysis. Oh, and you try to imagine if you put this in a time capsule, you know, you dug this up 100 years from now, it would just speak volumes about, this president in the future. Because, as you know, people have a tendency to either disappear in history sometimes or people just kind of forget what they did, especially negative and contemporaneous sense. But the other one, which is fabulous, is the jobs crisis.
Yes, they're just middle-class folk trying to catch a break, you know, provide for their families. They just need jobs.
you laugh because what else are you going to do? Cry?
It's sick and it's sad. I'm laughing because
you have to entertain your mind or else you literally would go crazy. You know, so first off, you're right. Chris Matthews bringing this up speaks volumes about the frustration with Obama, but it doesn't cure the disease. And I think it's helpful, and I welcome any mainstream media wake-up call. But let's face it, what we are witnessing in so much of this Obama euphoria, long since past the African-American, black-white glass ceiling of a president has gone away and lost its luster, right? Because, you know, that's like 6-year-old news already. But long after that luster is worn off, we still have a huge problem, which is that a significant amount of the population, somewhere not that far from 50%, seems perfectly comfortable with the irrational idea that we can get communism, socialism, progressivism, I don't care what ism you want to call it, but this disease where we neuter the individual, where we neuter liberty, and we somehow think that the collective statist mentality will get it right, no matter how many tens of millions of people have died in killing fields, no matter how many countries once free, you know, just can't wait to rid themselves of the long food lines, the mediocrity in every sense of the word, the lack of freedom, the lack of trust, you know, square little boxy cars that, you know, you had to carry, an extra quart of oil just to go, you know, to the store to wait in line for 2 hours for a loaf of bread. This is, And somehow all these socialist progressives, the same kind of people who would vote for Hillary, think this time we know how to do it right. It's like playing Russian roulette and just thinking, I think I'm going to count better this time. You know, at some point you're going to pull the trigger and it's going to go bang. And that, I think, is what you're worried about with Hillary, is if we pull the trigger for Hillary, you know, it's kind of like putting a gun to the temple of this great nation, this great democratic experiment.
No, absolutely. And unfortunately, a lot of people and, you know, that don't support Obama, think that this is all perfectly, you know, fine and good and that, you know, everything is just status quo right now. Most people are very uninformed. You know, they really don't understand the threats that we're facing, and they do watch kind of mainstream media or, you know, the Daily Report with Jon Stewart or something to that effect, and that's where they kind of get their news, and they're very happy, or they're very happy following people that they know and their opinions without actually learning facts and information for themselves. And so, yeah, when you have when you have these absolutely ridiculous statements, like all ISIS needs and wants are jobs, and, you know, if they just had those, they wouldn't be decapitating and burning people alive. Well, the average person is not really going to be looking into it too much more deeply than that. And, you know, at least, thank God, I mean, I give credit where credit is due, that Chris Matthews, challenged that absolute absurdity. And that's where the media comes in, and that's why it is so important for the media to actually do its job, because they are not doing anyone favors, including themselves, by carrying the water for these kind of absurd policies and stances.
Now, with the exception of people who serve in high-level leadership capacities, who choose to put themselves in the public spotlight, and also whose misgivings or conversely, greatness could have a profound effect on our country, on our nation, on our way of life, those people to me are always in the crosshairs, right? And I don't care whether you're talking about Boehner or Nancy Pelosi, whether you're talking about the president or the former president, et cetera. And I understand that the spokesmen and women who serve for the presidents or who serve for the Pentagon or for the Department of State, all of whom basically they're given marching orders. I understand that, but creating under Obama you want to talk about the proper use of the term JV, it doesn't just seem like you disagree with them. You know, I could understand where many people would have disagreed with George Bush's policies, but, you know, Dana Perino, for example, she was a brilliant spokeswoman. Harry Fleischer, you know, but both, and quite frankly, Clinton also had some very good, people speaking for him, but these people, it's almost like clowns. It's like watching Saturday Night Live.
Well, it is, and I almost feel bad for them, because they're trying to spin this. It really, I mean, what amounts to just garbage, and I almost feel badly for them, because, you know, what are they going to say? Their job is to spin it, and their job is to defend this guy and defend these policies and defend these ridiculous statements. And, you know, they're the ones who are in front of the camera, and they have to do it. And, you know, it's not a job I envy in any way, shape, or form.
Well, at least if they had a sense of humor, they might have a shot at replacing Jon Stewart or Al Sharpton on MSNBC. But I don't see that happening in the immediate future. So, Tiffany, you and I both follow with great personal passion and from a historical and national security perspective what's going on in Israel and also what's going on in world Jewry, because it's very difficult to not look at the Jews and anti-Semitism as a canary in civilization's mine. And so there were two things that really strike me right now. One is we have it seems like not a day goes by that we're not having something happening in Europe. And it's not in just one country. You know, countries like what happened in Denmark, for example, a couple of instances. This is a country, in fact, one of the few countries that actually had a nationwide effort to save its Jews during World War II. And, you know, with the rising Muslim population in that country, look how quickly you know, we see the tide turn, and from canceled events and from damaged studios and from violence and death, these events affecting Jews all over the place. And then we flip to the other side of the globe, and we see all over the Middle East Christians being killed and slaughtered. And make no mistake, the only reason why you're not seeing Jews killed and slaughtered in these countries, because they already threw most of them out or killed them already back around 1948 when Israel was first declared a nation state. With all that in mind, we then come up to one of the biggest issues we have with the president is his complete lack of willingness. And let's get out of this thing about pretending he's a dunce, doom cuffed idiot. He's not. He's actually he's not the smartest man to walk the planet. He doesn't walk on water as many liberals think, but he's certainly no idiot, far from it. And yet he has made an absolute case that he and all of his crazy far-left radical minions are going to avoid ever using the terms Islamic, radical Islamic, Muslim, anything to identify that, no matter how many times we repeat this. And the president, now the White House, just today has begun hosting a three-day summit to examine ways to counter violent extremism. So when you talk about violent extremism, I don't know, are we talking about gang violence in Chicago? I mean, what exactly are we talking about here?
Yeah, and he was very quick to make sure to say that it comes in all different shapes and sizes, this kind of violent extremism. You know, because did anyone think that he might be singling out Muslims or Islamic extremism?
I think there's 10 things I want to say, most of which I really should bite my tongue on. But one of the things that so irritates me on this is the fact that it's so blatantly destructive, but to everybody. I have, you've seen me use this more and more lately, but I have this very simple sort of tagline that I've basically distilled this entire thing down to, which is reformation or conflagration. I don't see any chance of avoiding a major global war that will affect everybody, that will drag everybody in. Okay, this is not crazy talk. I mean, these things have continuously happened throughout history. It's naive to think they won't happen again. It's a matter of when you see them coming, are you helping to sow the seeds? You know, the president is like watching him operate in the White House and watching the State Department operate underneath him is something along the lines of watching these crazy people in that curling sport in the Olympics, right? These lunatics running around with brooms. But at least while they're playing their silly game, they're not hurting anybody. and it's almost like, he's brushing the ice, so that curling stone of radical Islam will manage to reach its final course, to create this calamity and this chaos. But it's so troubling to me because it's so blatantly obvious, and it's not like it's even doing any justice to Muslims. If you look at the polls, there's no way that you could say reasonably that radical Islam is just a tiny little percentage of people, because poll after poll after poll in most of these countries show usually a plurality of people who want Sharia law, who think that things like that Ben Shapiro, you may have seen the video he did a couple of months ago, but he did a great analysis in this where they took major research studies from so many of the Muslim countries. And when you listen to the people in their own polling, you realize that extremism, meaning a way of life that is completely out of sync with Western civ, is fairly popular. But that doesn't mean that it's all of them. That means there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of Muslims who literally are prisoners in their own countries. And so, to me, you're doing not just a great disservice to the pillar of Western civilization, Judeo-Christian values, but you're doing an enormous disservice to pluralistic, reformist-minded Muslims who realize that the original book is taken in a complete, rigid, non-interpretive fashion as the word of God is going to yield nothing but endless violence and chaos. And that's exactly what we're seeing playing out. So to try to in some way divorce this reality from what the bad guys are doing and even what the bad guys are saying, even what the bad guys plan, and to me, you can only say is either flat-out complicity or insanity. And unfortunately, I don't think he's stupid, and I also don't think he's insane.
No, I agree with you. And there are so many good points that you brought up that I want to touch on. I'll try to work backward a little bit. With regard to Islamic extremism and not wanting to identify the threat and the origins of the threat, as we saw at the National Prayer Breakfast, Obama had absolutely no problem invoking the Christian Crusades and labeling Christians and condemning Christians for, a half a millennia old pursuit. If these were progressives talking, they would have absolutely no qualms saying, oh, well, Christian extremists or abortion clinic bombers or labeling it any other religion. But when it comes to Islam, there is just some kind of mute button. And it is so destructive, because how can you have a conference, a summit on combating extremism when you're not even willing to admit what the actual cause of the problem is? And I'm going to go back a little bit to what, to the State Department's assertion that this is all about jobs, apparently, for ISIS. And if you go on and you see the reaction in Europe, this is all because of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Everybody wants to blame everything else except what the actual problem is, and that is a religion. Okay, you cannot separate the two, and there was a wonderful piece that you forwarded me that talks very much about that. What does ISIS really want, and what is really fueling their fire? What is the root of their motivation? It is 100% canonical. And that's very much true for the Muslim Brotherhood, and that was very much true for Al-Qaeda. And they themselves are seeing themselves as interpreting the Quran and the Hadith very much true to form. And that it's the people who are moderates that are actually blasphemers or people who are perverting the religion. So unless you actually acknowledge that, how can you ever root it out? You won't even identify what the problem is. And this is a very, very big problem. And it is all interconnected, because you mentioned the anti-Semitism that's just absolutely every day. There's something new coming out in the news. There were, I believe, 20 cars spray-painted with swastikas and different anti-Semitic slogans in Paris. There were graves that were just vandalized in eastern France, hundreds of great Jewish graves that were desecrated just the other day. Obviously, we know about the shootings that just took place. And unfortunately, the European reaction is, well, you know what, while we condemn these attacks, if we just saw the Israeli-Palestinian problem, this is absolutely ridiculous. And until you would think that being assaulted in their own cities, allowing this problem to reach the proportions that it has, you would think that they would acknowledge, what the root of the problem is, but they still seem unwilling to do so. They want to blame Jews again, in Israel, of course. So it's a familiar nugget, and anybody who says that claiming anti-Semitism still exists is just right-wing hyperbole is really living in an alternate reality. So, I have a lot of other thoughts I have to bite my tongue on. But.
No, I understand. I suffer from that daily. I have a permanent. If I need molds again at the dentist, they don't have to put that goop in my mouth. All they need to do is take a laser impression of my tongue. All the molds they need. I want to touch on the jobs program a little bit, because there are, besides the obvious insanity here. Sorry.
I think I might have lost you.
No. I had a quick attack of coughing. Hardly biting your tongue might break off teeth. So, if you go back to this jobs program thing, part of what's so disgusting about this is the fact that you're trying to intermingle socialist policies at home with foreign policy. And I have always taken the approach that I want my national leaders to focus more on foreign policy than on domestic policy. Now, that flies in the face of the polls and how most people vote, but I think, well, quite frankly, I think most people are stupid in that regard. All right? That's it. I said it. Most people are stupid. But I mean that in a only half-joking way. There is very little of society's ills that can't be solved at the state level or with mechanisms that are already in place. I mean, we have, mm-hmm. as a society, in a relatively short number of years, we have overcome so many problems, and we did those, yes, we did them at the federal level, and we did them at the state level, and we did them through courts, but we did them with a tiny central government. I mean, if you look back at many of the historical problems, we solved them with a tiny central government. Now we have this enormous government, and it seems like the problems are magnifying. We're not moving further down the pipe. Anyway, Satu, what do I really need the government to do? Protect me. Okay, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or the new guys, you know, the Sergey Brins, the Zuckerbergs, I mean, any of these new folks in business or technology, they can't solve the problem of keeping our borders safe. They can't fight foreign armies. They can't run intelligence gathering in other nations. You know, they can't build ships, capital ships and bombs and weapon systems to defeat our enemies before they defeat us. If you think of all the things you really need government to do, the only one I really, really, really need them to focus on is to protect and defend our country and our Constitution. And so to intermingle these two, to me, is itself, I think, you know, problematic and insulting to my intelligence, certainly. But the other thing is, so blatantly, indefensibly wrong. First off, ISIS is a jobs program. So let's be clear. A lot of money being funneled to these people. They're stealing money, but they're also stealing oil, and they're selling, you know, $1 to $3 million a day, a lot of money, to and remember, we discussed recently on the show that ISIS is actually the best funded of all the terror organizations in the world, followed by Hezbollah, I think, was number two, and Hamas number four. But anyway, they have plenty of money, and they're selling, they're creating jobs, and they're selling it through. So it's just stupid to say it's jobs. Second of all, we already know, we have seen doctors, lawyers, business professionals, we've seen all kinds of people with jobs, a lot of folks out of work would love to have, who have left their jobs to go fight as radicals. So to think that this is animated by a lack of jobs is silly, you know, because, look, you could look all over just south of our border in Central and South America, and you're not seeing jobs, you know, leading the beheadings of Christians and Jews. You're just not seeing that. So I take great offense to that.
Oh, absolutely. One of my friends made a great point. You know, the Tibetans are oppressed, and you don't see them rising up. And if some Tibetan went and killed someone of Chinese descent in Europe, they would be blaming what? I mean, who would they be blaming? China, it's absolutely absurd. So the double standard, the hypocrisy, the sheer blindness, the willful blindness, I should say, is absolutely staggering. And then I couldn't agree with you more that really our nation was built to be very state-level oriented, correct? I mean, that was obviously what our founders had in mind. They wanted states to be able to govern their own affairs. So you're right. When it comes to those kitchen table issues, I absolutely believe that there is very little that our own local state governments really can't do for us. And in a leader, I do want foreign policy chops. And I do want that kind of statesmanship. And unfortunately, that's something that we've been sorely lacking. You know, I wouldn't mind a little military background, too, but that seems to be too much to ask these days.
That seems too much to ask. Well, some of that is because so far fewer people do serve in the military, and you can argue that's both a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, it's a good thing that we can get away with that. It's a bad thing because there's a sense of reality and sobriety that I think comes from serving in uniform or having immediate family members serving in uniform. Tiffany, have you ever seen the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Of course, yeah. It's been many years, but
I think to me it's an all-time classic. I think it's one of the best sarcasm pieces ever done, and totally amplified by the brilliance of British dry wit humor. I was just sitting here while you were talking, and thinking to myself, if I had $25 million to burn a hole in my pocket, maybe it'd be $50 or $100 million nowadays. I would love to fund. Imagine getting that troop together, and I understand, I can't say the same, that the dude died recently, but I would love to see a redo in a movie like that to actually play mockery on what is going on in the real world with the radical Islamists right now, and take them to task exactly as they did to take the Christian holy warriors to task as they did in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It had so much brilliant commentary of life at that time, and how brilliant it would have been to see it repeated today.
I couldn't agree more.
Of course, we're now being joined by our good friend Jim Robbins. Jim, I don't know if you heard that last comment. I was just saying that if I had a dream right now, it'd be to have the Monty Python guys get back together and do a show on radical Islam. In the same style they did the Holy Grail. I think it would be brilliant, and in sort of a John Stewart style, maybe it would help educate the 50% of the masses who just can't seem to see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, that's if it didn't get boycotted beforehand for bigotry and Islamophobia.
Absolutely. Jim, welcome to the show. Chime in, please.
Well, it might be funny that some of the stuff is really beyond parody. Particularly the administration's responses to these kinds of things. I think it's almost beyond mockery, the ridiculousness of it all. The headlines that we see coming out of the White House look like they could be something in The Onion.
Definitely. You know, in fact, I've posted things and people, is that an onion? Is that an onion article?
Like the State Department, you know, hey, if only the ISIS guys had good jobs, that they wouldn't resort to terrorism, which it just shows how you don't want to have amateurs handling your notion of root causes of terrorism. I mean, and not only is it not true that they wouldn't do that, but it's just so ridiculous. Is it really our job to secure jobs for the ISIS guys? What do we want, a stimulus package? Is this a lead up to some new policy? Or maybe we could just put them on unemployment benefits, since Nancy Pelosi says that's a job creator. And, you know, keep them on unemployment benefits and just keep extending it so long as they're not burning people alive and, you know, attacking other folks. Wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah, and if they're on unemployment, we certainly won't report that they are, because we don't want to get that 5.6 magic number, you know, percent increase.
I believe Nancy Math was $3 back to the economy for every $1 we outguess, I mean invest, in unemployment. Jim, I wanted to go over right to what's happening in Europe and Israel. So, as you know, because we've been discussing it on the show, there has been a huge problem with Obama not only tripping over himself to avoid calling radical Islam by its name or any of its iterations, but he's actually been undermining our allies, Egypt and Israel, Israel in particular, and he's doing everything possible to neuter and undermine Netanyahu, the president of Israel, the prime minister of Israel, while at the same time actually doing the exact opposite of what he's claiming should never be done, you know, interfering in another government. And I was very happy to see two things. One, that it's failing miserably. Israelis, left, right, and center, are actually coalescing further away from. The numbers continue to increase on those, even on the left, who simply don't like and don't trust, as they know, and they see him at least as a fifth column leader. The second thing is, I was happy to see that there's greater support for Netanyahu, and you're also seeing Netanyahu is now getting support from some of his competitors on the right, like Naftali Bennett, who gave a very very short, simple speech to the Europeans, basically reminding them that Israel is on the front lines of the war between the free and civilized worlds and radical Islamist terrorists. So I was very happy to see that, because I think it's going to be necessary. You don't want to leave Bibi out there fighting alone against this president. That's not a good thing.
You know, I think it's all going to come down to the substance of the speech. All of this debate before the speech is going to be irrelevant, and you know, who's up, who's down, who offended whom first, who was lying about it, which wasn't Netanyahu, and so forth. it'll all come down to, does he give a great speech? I'm fairly certain he will. I don't think the man cannot give a great speech. And the events that have been taking place recently all tend to support the view of the world that Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to talk about before Congress. An increasingly chaotic world, a world that can't wait for strategic patience to kick in, an increasingly dangerous and violent world, and one in which you have to call things what they are, and I certainly hope you will do that. The White House has been avoiding all of these questions and looking weak, and that only emboldens our adversaries around the world. So it'll be great when he comes here, gives his speech, and then people can talk about the substance of it rather than all this gaming about the politics of it and this other nonsense.
Well, I think you're spot on. He has all the evidence on his side because the president has been very untransparent. Iran has been blatantly threatening and continuing not only to threaten Israel, but to continue to build weapons and weapon systems. Remember, this is far more than just nuclear bomb. This is about the defensive and the offensive weapon systems that surround that. It's not good enough if you're not an entire suicidal nation state to just have a bomb. But I wanted to take this a little bit closer to the borders of Israel because the other part of the message that Netanyahu has been saying, and again, Naftali Bennett just did a nice job of supporting, is this is not just about Iran. This is not just about Hamas. This is not just about ISIS. It's not just about Boko Haram. It's about all these character actors, including Hamas, including Hezbollah, even including the Palestinian Authority, who essentially is a terrorist organization funded by the U.S. Can't even believe I have to say that. I wanted to touch on two interesting things with Hezbollah, and then I'd like to get your comments, Jen, followed by you, Tiffany. So one is Hezbollah has rearmed massively in and under the and in violation of the ceasefire from the 2006 very brief war with Israel, and Israel did a pretty poor job there. I mean, they didn't lose militarily, but they basically were pretty inept and not really well prepared, and they lost a media war, and they had a lot of random rocket hits all over the place. But Hezbollah only had maybe a 10,000 or so relatively small, not particularly accurate rockets. In the aftermath, you now have somewhere between 100 on the low side and 150,000 missiles, longer range, some number of thousands of them, can reach anywhere in Israel. They're bigger payloads, more accurate, and the problem is that speaks volumes for a plan that could overwhelm an Iron Dome system. Unless they have an extra 1,000 Iron Dome batteries laying around that nobody knows about, that poses a big problem. The second side of that is this is part, remember, Hezbollah is nothing more than a branded extension of Iran's Republican National Guard. A Republican Guard, and these guys are basically working under Iran to undermine Israel. Now, the second thing that is a huge problem that ties into that is just now reports are coming out from the intelligence services that thousands of Afghani and Pakistani are joining Hezbollah in the Golan. What's coming? I mean, it's definitely coming, and so I want to get your comment on both of those because you wrap all that up, and again, you cannot ignore the equation that this involves Iran at the same time our president seems to continue to surrender to same.
Yeah, it just underscores the threat. I mean, how are Afghans from Western Afghanistan getting to Golan anyway? Through Iran and with Iranian pay? Of course. So it underscores what the locus of the threat is, Iran, and the danger in coming to a grand bargain with Iran regarding nukes and other things. The thing that I've always thought about nuclear weapons, apart from the threat of their offensive use, is their effect on the deterrent framework of the region. Iran is already this adventurous, revolutionary, expansionist power. So if they have nuclear weapons, and can deter any kind of concerted attack on them from the West, how much more adventurous will they be? How much more of this kind of junk will we see? because they will be able to punch back hard if a country decides to take decisive action against them, be it Israel or the United States. Not likely in our case, but I'm thinking of future presidents. And that's, to me, the more proximate threat. Not that Iran will get nuclear weapons and use them, but they will obtain them, and the first thing they'll do is start blackmailing the region and start engaging in more of this kind of activity. We see what they're doing even without this, even without nuclear weapons as a deterrent. How much more so will we see once they have them? To me, that's the threat.
Tiffany, is it conceivable that the Democrats in this country and the liberals, meaning the majority of the folks in office in Europe, could they possibly be blind, willfully blind, or even just too stupid to see this threat and that it actually is as big a threat to them, maybe a day, a week, a month, or a year later than Israel, but it's the same exact threat?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you have some people who are truly naive and who think that, you know, gee, if we just cooperate, if we just try to negotiate with Iran, you know, they'll become a partner with us. They're the strongest force really in the region. And, you know, yeah, you know, technically the OPEC guys are kind of bad guys anyway. Maybe they would be more of a balancing force in the region if we could, Iran that is, if we could just reach out to them and make them a partner. So I do think that there are some who are genuinely that naive and who think that if we extend this hand to Iran, they will become a partner and a working partner with us that would ever care about Western interests and not just their own. However, with regard to Obama, no, I don't think he's that naive and I don't think he's that dumb. I think that he knows exactly what he's dealing with, and I think he wants there to be a power shift in the region. It strains belief that he would be that naive, particularly with the fact that he does have advisors and he does have strategists and he does have people who he is surrounded by who knows the region and knows the dynamic and knows the people better than he does. And so I think with regard to Obama, I do think that it's a very deliberate strategy to shift power in the Middle East. And I mean, when you look at every country, when you look at Egypt, Libya, Syria, Yemen, I mean, it's very hard to believe that he just didn't know what he was doing and in over his head the entire time. Hello?
Yeah.
Am I still on?
Tiffany,
okay,
just,
sorry.
Yep. Sorry. I kept my finger on the call button. So you may be a little bit young to remember the day-to-day goings-on of the Iran-Contra. I know Jim isn't, but Jim, there was something that came out very, the Russians, through their Pravda mouthpiece, are actually now talking about Russian armed forces returning to Latin America. So first off, the article itself is very interesting because they're talking about a couple of new submarines that are being commissioned for use there. Of course, we should absolutely expect that Russia will have a base there. I'll be surprised if by the time this president is out of office, if we don't see Guantanamo Bay become a Russian base, but, you know, maybe an Iranian base, maybe a shared base, who knows. But I want to focus on one word in particular, which is returning to Latin America, because if you go back to the whole Iran-Contra, if you go back to the mid-80s and under Ronald Reagan, and you remember the characters, we had, of course, George Shultz and Weinberger and Nice, and so forth. But this is where Ali North, came out of, the quiet military world to all of a sudden become a public name. But, Jim, I wanted to bring this up because it troubles me that we're not just fighting war against radical Islam and a growing Russian threat and so forth, but we're literally going exactly back to where the other guy, where we were 30 years ago. Problem I have is that even back then, the left if you recall, many of the people on the left were still trying to blame Reagan, like he was crazy. There wasn't really this Russian threat. There wasn't this communist threat on the border. By the way, there's still communist forces in that Mexico has a hard time dealing with in their southern provinces. I want to get your commentary on that threat, Jim, and obviously I think it's something we'll be tracking in future Tuesdays with you.
Well, history never stopped. That's part of the problem. I think that some people on the left and even the right would have hoped that with the downfall of communism that everything would be hunky-dory in some way. But the fact is that countries pursue their interests, their strategic interests, economic interests, whatever they happen to be. And the United States, although less so now, but it is still the biggest kid on the block. And so other countries are going to come after us. If Russia sees an opening in Latin America where they can project their power and influence, yeah, they're going to do that. And let's not forget China. It's actually worse than it was in the 80s in some respects because the Chinese are looking for means to project power. They have a toehold in Latin America too. And there may be a day when we see a Chinese aircraft carrier cruising around in the Caribbean. Well, that wouldn't even have been allowed back in the Cold War. I mean, that just, you know, we would just have stopped that somehow. But these days, it will be allowed. I think that it's highly probable in the next 10 years that we're going to see something like that, a Chinese Great White Fleet making a world tour. And what are we going to do about it? You know, Russian submarine bases in Latin America. Okay, that's highly probable. They've already restarted their nuclear submarine patrols around our country that they had called off at the end of the Cold War. They've been increasingly aggressive with their bomber incursions into our airspace, and they're building up their strategic missile forces. So, you know, they still have a grasp on what strategy is and how to use it. We're the ones who are letting that go, and so we're going to pay the consequences.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. Tiffany, back around a similar time frame, and Jim, you may recall the exact dates. I want to say it was either at the end of the Carter administration or sometime early in the Reagan administration, the Democrats in power at the time had neutered our intelligence services and related foreign policy by disallowing us to work with quote-unquote bad guys. So, of course, all that does is drive much of that underground, a la the Iran-Contra affair. One of the problems that I have when you look at this history, though, Tiffany, is there any way in your mind that we can solve all these world's problems without having and dealing with bad guys, people who we might have no respect for, and if we have to deal with them, how do we prevent the problems that very often happens is where we help them and we give them weapons, as we did in Afghanistan, for example, and then we turn around 5 years later and they're using those weapons against us.
Okay, could you just repeat the question? Because you're a little bit fuzzy there with the connection.
No, sorry, I know you were had a challenged connection. What I was basically pointing to is we have had legal policies in the past that neutered our intelligence and military services from dealing with bad actors, bad characters around the world. And when you look at what's going on now, no different than 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, or 100 years ago, you always have bad actors you have to deal with. So the first thing is, shouldn't we be more fair and more open in a political dialogue about the fact that we have to deal with these with bad characters because, you know, much of the world is filled with bad characters? The second part of that question is, assuming we have to deal with those bad characters, how do we prevent those bad characters from turning around shortly thereafter and becoming our enemies?
Well, I mean, I think that's a $64,000 question. I mean, look, especially when it comes to the Middle East, it's always been the lesser of two evils. Did anybody think Mubarak was a great guy? No, but you know what? There was a reason that he was in place. There was a reason for martial law in Egypt, and there was a reason why we supported him and why we were, you know, we had a friendly relationship. It's exactly the same thing with Gaddafi. I mean, no one could argue that Gaddafi was a good guy, but you know what? He vowed to work with us on rooting out terrorism. He got to give up his chemical weapons pursuit, and we then betrayed him. But then again, we're the same people who, you know, who basically did arm a young Osama bin Laden. So I think obviously a lot of it does come down to working with our intelligence agencies and getting as good and, you know, as strong intelligence as possible to make those sound decisions. So unfortunately, when it comes to dealing with them, But there does have to be at least, you know, a recollection of the past and try, you know, at least let's try not to keep making these same mistakes. And that's something that I think this administration has really not heeded, are those lessons from the past. So
moving back toward the Russian front, we have this Ukrainian peace deal in place, which, of course, is already being divided. And I think this is a perfect example of where we have to look at the idea of good character is bad. When you look at Ukraine contemporaneously and historically, there's a lot of bad actors in Ukraine on both sides of the aisle, right? I mean, Ukraine has been there's no geographically defensive positions for the most part in Ukraine, right? A lot of big open flat spaces, a lot of great soil for growing things. But it happens to be on the path between, whether you're talking about the Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, Germans, empires of last century, the Russian empires of hundreds of years, Genghis Khan and the like. It doesn't matter what direction they're looking from. They're kind of in the crossroads, and I think that's probably led to a people who are, I don't know, pretty angry, nasty, gritty, and, you know, seem to not necessarily be anybody's friend. But, Jim, when you look at them, isn't that almost a perfect case of a situation where, you know, we have to kind of pinch our nose and deal, and I don't by any means want to compare them to some of the other bad guys out there, but isn't this a perfect example of one of those bad guy scenarios where we have to really carefully decide what do we do and how do we deal with them, and how important is it that we keep Russia from continuing to perpetrate Putin's plan of Russian hegemony?
Yes, it's complicated because you don't want to reward aggression, and that's what Russia's engaged in, is international aggression. Ukraine is not a NATO state, which is a problem for them. Had they been a NATO state, there'd be no question, because we have to uphold the Atlantic Treaty. So we really have to decide what we're going to do, how much we're going to respond to it, and how much we want to stand up for it. Obviously, if we, you know, they wanted us to send in ground troops, that's not going to happen, and we can't fight that thing. Russia has been very clever about not overtly inserting troops, of course, covertly, yes. So there's no legal rationale for open warfare in that respect. But on the other hand, Russia has already annexed Crimea. They're probably going to be annexing whatever they can get out of eastern Ukraine when they can. And so the question comes, do we want to sit by and do nothing as a country is dismembered in the way like Czechoslovakia was back in 1938 and 39? And I don't think that we do, because the more you reward that behavior, the more of it you're going to get. But on the other hand, we can't just go intervene whole hog and try to fight this out, because it just wouldn't be feasible. Furthermore, it would give Russia a pretext for taking even more action, and at the end of the day, if it came out to an open war, they would win it. And we just wouldn't be able to cope with that. So I think the steps we're taking are pretty good. Maybe we could arm Ukraine more than just sending them blankets. I don't think sending them blankets is all that useful. Maybe some anti-tank weapons would help, since the Russians are sending in tanks and armored personnel carriers. But there are definite limits to how far we can go with that.
Now, there is still a significant number of weapons in the Ukrainian arsenal, but they absolutely don't necessarily have the more Russia, in many cases, they're actually the same weapons on both sides. Russia has had the money to update their electronics and many other things, so Russia would clearly have an advantage in every sense. And as I pointed out to the terrain, it's not necessarily an ideal. It's not like Afghanistan, which is ideal for guerrilla warfare, right? So it'd be pretty difficult for them. But this is where I also go back to why I was saying at the beginning of the show, like foreign policy and leadership is so critically important, because The best weapon I believe we still have in our arsenal, and to the president's credit, he is using a tiny bit of it, is to use our economy as a weapon, And, you know, I think we would have 2-3 years ago already brought Iran to its knees had we kept doing it. I think we need to be applying it here. I'm going to give each of you a chance, sort of about a minute and a half each, to sort of give your commentary on that, wrap up on any other thoughts that you'd like. We've got about 4 minutes left in the show.
Jim, why don't you start?
Oh, well, I agree that diplomacy is important and that sanctions are important. Intelligence support, anything we can do to help Ukrainians and to try to pressure Moscow without going to some kind of open warfare scenario would be useful. There are already sanctions on Russia, and more sanctions would probably be better. All the other tools are at our disposal. I don't know to what extent we're cooperating with Ukraine in the intelligence domain, for example, but if the United States was intercepting information through our vast NSA that we pay for, if we are intercepting information that would prove the case that Russia is actively involved in this, you know, in ways more so than has already been proven, then maybe we should start to make some of that information public. I mean, what's Russia going to do about it? Why not make it public? Why not try to humiliate them or show that they are breaking international law and make them more of an international pariah state? So long as we're not giving up our sources and methods or, you know, compromising sources, then why not? I think that would be a great way to do things, and I don't think we do enough of that because we're so concerned about protecting how our assets work. Well, you know what? In the post-Snowden era, I think a lot of the cat is out of the bag right now, and we should be using more of this information in a public diplomacy way to humiliate rather than just hanging on to it and never actually using it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think post-Snowden, a lot has changed in the game, and I think we do need to use our information and our intelligence, and as you said, engage in humiliation tactics and you know, any other measure that we have at our disposal. But again, whether it's dealing with Russia or whether it's dealing with, you know, Islamic terrorists, one thing that we need to do is convey strength. And that's something that Putin has effectively done and showed his people and is showing the world. And he's very irreverent about it. And that's something that, unfortunately, our administration lacks. It's actually quite the opposite. So, again, positions of strength are typically always respected by, you know, by other peoples in other countries and by our own people. So I think at the end of the day, that's something that would behoove this administration to engage in more, and I doubt that it will, but certainly advice for the next administration coming in.
Well, what I hear you both saying, and first I want to thank you both, James Robbins and Tiffany Gabay, for joining us here on The Final Say, but what I hear you both saying is that we need to stand up for American exceptionalism, and we need not be shy about having, you know, we have to do some things in secrecy, but we can actually do probably a lot more overt things. Nowadays, it's almost impossible to keep information from leaking and flowing wildly throughout the world, so we need to learn to use it to our advantage, which, by the way, should be something that a free democracy ought to be able to do. I want to close the show with an irony alert on the same thing. Is Justice Ginsburg was actually just bemoaning Congress about how biased and useless Congress is, but I just thought it was kind of ironic because this coming from somebody whose voting record would show that she is every bit as biased and polarized as anybody in Congress is. But I think when you put these two things together, it does show that we need leadership that cares more about our country than their party and that is not afraid to stand up for American exceptionalism. And ladies and gentlemen, we are not afraid to stand up for American exceptionalism. We do it every day from 3 to 4 p.m. here on the Final Say Radio Show because without it, the world is not a particularly pretty place. So thanks for joining us. Again, thanks to James Robbins and Tiffany Gabay. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern. After that.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcast, go to www.rappaport.com. thefinalsay.com.